The next case is 97-851, State of Ohio versus Michael Dye. Before beginning argument, that at precisely at 9:50, we're told that the Ohio Building Authority is going to test our tornado alert system, and we are attempting to be uninterrupted, and so we're going to turn off the sound system here, and hopefully we won't hear the person telling us what to do, and the siren's going to run for 3 minutes. Mr. Bogdanoff, I think you are probably going to be still arguing at 9:50, I would guess, if you're true to form. What I would suggest is you just continue your argument unless you believe that the sound coming in from outside is disruptive, at which point tell us that, and we'll stop your time and we'll wait for the system to work through. And I should say also that this is probably the safest room in the building, so if there were a tornado, this is where we'd want you to stay rather than run out in the street. So you may begin.
Please record, my name is Phil Bogdanoff. I represent the state of Ohio. I would like to reserve another time for the main rebuttal. At the time of our arguments, Mr. Walsh is speaking when the tornado goes. Your Honor, the reason stated before you is that the Ninth District Court of Appeals reversed the defendant's life sentence, indicating that the state failed to prove force in this case. The court indicated that when a non-parental authority figure sexually abuses the young child, that although aspiration applies, that this non-parental authority figure does not represent the same level of implicit threat of punishment as a parent. And therefore, the Ninth District Court of Appeals indicated there must be a higher standard of proof with regard to force than the aspiration standard. The court indicated that there are three specific factors that the state must prove. Number one, that there was an express threat of harm, or number two, evidence of significant physical restraint, or three, evidence that the victim was afraid of the offender and had previously witnessed violence by the offender. The state contends that this higher burden of proof with regard to force is incorrect and must be reversed. The state contends when a non-parental authority figure sexually abuses the young child, that this court should look at the totality of the circumstances to determine whether or not force is proved. In an estuary, this court indicated that force need not be overt and physically brutal, but can be subtle and psychological. Basically, the state has proved that the rape victim's will was overborne by fear and duress.
Mr. Bogdanoff, even though it might be difficult for any of us to fathom how you could have sex with a child under 13 that's not somewhat force a result of force, nevertheless, the statute does make that distinction in terms of penalty and crime and elements. If this is what distinction would you have for force and non-force? We know the parental makes some sense, but how would you define it if differently than the Court of Appeals?
Well, Your Honor, the defendant in his brief has set forth three cases where the state would indicate there was no force, and the Court of Appeals indicated in those cases that force did not approve. One case that stands out in my mind is State versus Wood, which is cited in the defendant's brief. In that case, a mother was with her 5-year-old child, and she thought the 5-year-old child would be able to use the men's restroom by himself, so she stayed outside while the little boy went inside the restroom. While the boy was in the stall, the defendant creeped underneath the stall, went up to the boy, and put his mouth on the little boy's penis. The little boy came outside and told his mommy that this man put his mouth on his penis. The little boy did not know this man at all. and there essentially was no force involved. So that would be a case where there was no force. I think there's one other case that he cited where a child went up to a the defendant and just put her mouth on the defendant's penis. And again, the court appeals reversed, saying there was no force. So I can't imagine there being cases where there is no force. But where you have a relationship where a non-parental authority figure, I think you have to look at that relationship to determine whether or not there is force involved. And as a matter of fact, the leading case that is cited by the defendants and by the state is State versus Eskridge. And I would remind you, of course, in State versus Eskridge, that the father was a non-custodial father. He did not live with the mother.
Does force go to the actual touching, and you know, in the dissent here, you know, the dissenting judge says, you know, they turn the child around and things like that, or does force go to the volition that there would be, I mean, in the scenarios that you just recite for us, those cases, it wasn't a matter of the child was willing, it was no physical force, but we are using this the idea of mental force in Eskridge, so.
Yeah, that's correct. I think Eskridge's court set forth mental coercion, psychological coercion, and I think you have to look at all the circumstances. So you look at the act itself and the circumstances surrounding the act, including
to do what?
Relationship. To determine, based on this relationship, is the young child's will overborne by the defendant? Look at how.
So it should be the will. It should be coercion.
Coercion.
Physical or mental.
That is correct. And that's basically what this court held in Eskridge. And I think in Eskridge, there were two main factors that were looked at. Number one, there was a biological relationship between the father and the daughter. But number two, because it was a non-custodial father, the father did not live with the mother. The second factor was the father was babysitting the young child at the time that the sexual abuse occurred. And that's the same position that is put forth by the state, that if you have a babysitter abusing the child, that is a non-parental authority figure.
But you
have to look at the relationship.
What you seem to want us to do is to have force presumed under a certain age.
No, Your Honor, that is not my point. I'm not saying I haven't even mentioned age. I am saying look at their relationship. And you can look at the age, but that would be one factor. I'm not saying you presume force. I'm saying you look at the relationship to see whether or not the child's will is overborne.
The relationship, in this case, didn't the mother even tell the little boy to mind the defendant, and if he did not do that, she would not permit him to stay over?
That's correct.
So the test could be, what is the relationship between the minor and the adult figure?
I guess when you use the word test, I'm just saying look at all the factors. And another factor that should be considered is the fact that the defendant, when he gave the statement, admitted that he was in charge of this young child. So that is another factor to look at. The mother had known the defendant for 7 years. That's another factor. There's obviously some kind of close relationship.
In the case of the babysitter arrangement, it's a required arrangement. In the case of parent and child, it's a required arrangement. In this one, was this child required to go once a week to the defendant's house, or was it voluntary?
And Your Honor, you say required, I'm not sure if I understand. A parent, I know a lot of parents that do not watch their children. You may have a non-custodial parent who has a biological relationship. He may see the child once a year. So when you say it's required, I'm not sure if I agree with you. I think each case is...
I don't know what you're disagreeing with. I didn't say anything.
Okay.
I just wanted to know what the relationship was. Is it something that they had to do because it was a babysitting arrangement? Every one of the cases you've given us has been a relationship.
Mr. Walsh.
May it
please report. My name is Michael Walsh, and I represent the appellee, Michael Dye. Before I turn to my argument, I'd like to address two of the questions that were asked of Attorney Bogdanoff. First, Justice Douglas, you asked whether this was a babysitting situation. In fact, the record does reflect that the victim in this case voluntarily went to Mr. Dye's house and sought during a minor period of time to go to this house. There was no requirement that he attend, that he visit Mr. Dye. He went of his own volition.
Does that negate force when he's actually there?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. However, it is one of the factors, as Mr. Bogdanoff indicated, we need to look at all the factors involved to determine whether there was force. In this case, there was no evidence of force. There were no bruises, cuts, abrasions on the victim. The victim indicated that he was not afraid of Mr. Dye, that he considered Mr. Dye a friend.
The victim also didn't hurt him when he did this.
That's correct. There's one reference in the victim's testimony that he was hurt during the first time.
Only the first time?
I believe so, Your Honor.
Your argument then, Mr. Walsh, is that the dissent in the Court of Appeals wants to read force, and we know that district has read force in any sort of, you know, here in the movement of the child, in the, you know, removing of clothing. What do you say about that? Do you want us to say that that is not force in the sense that this General Assembly intended it? Is that what's your argument on that?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's the second point that I wanted to address. In Eskridge, on page 58 of this court's decision, this court said that the force, when it's apparent child rape, the force that is required to commit the act is all the force that is required to prove the sentence enhancement of force. When it's not a parent-child relationship, as the Court of Appeals found, there must be something more. The parent-child relationship, as this court found in three benchmark decisions, State v. Lattice in 1921, Eskridge in 1988, State v. Shine in 1992, the parent-child relationship is the critical factor. A child has a duty to obey his parent. A failure to follow a parent's command carries with it to the that same press punishment does not apply when the victim is sexually abused by a non-parent. Justice Cook, you commented that you couldn't understand how there couldn't be force in a situation like this. And I tend to agree with you with this, as this court recognized in Eskridge, there is force implicit in any sexual assault. However, the General Assembly has required that there be something extra, something in addition, to prove force to require a life sentence under the penalty of cancer.
Did the defense counsel object to the question of force being submitted to the jury?
There is not an objection to the jury instruction, Your Honor. However, there were discussions prior to the jury being instructed about whether force had been proven. So, in the answer to your question, no to the jury instruction, but yes in the form of a Rule 29 motion.
Okay, and it was submitted, and the jury came back and found that on the issue of force, the jury determined that there was sufficient evidence to show force.
Yes, Your Honor. The jury did that based on the state's argument under Eskridge that something less needs to be shown where there is a parent and child involved in sexual abuse. Mr. Bogdanoff has indicated that we need to look at different factors, and we agree wholeheartedly that that's correct. Looking at the factors involved in this case, this is not a parent-child relationship. That takes this abuse out of the Eskridge formulation. As the Court of Appeals decided in this case, that means there must be something more shown. That does not mean that this is the same as adult sexual abuse. The age of the child should be taken into account. This court held in Silvitz and Eskridge that the courts should consider the age of the parties, the size of the parties, and the strength of the parties, in addition to the parent-child relationship. This court now has before it the chance to consider what standards should apply when it's not a parent-child relationship, but when it's a child who is abused by a friend of the family. Looking at the facts here, the age of the victim is known in the record. He was 9 years old during the time of the abuse. There is no reference in the record to the age of the defendant. There is no reference in the record to the size of the defendant. There's no reference in the records to the strength of the defendant. While the jury may have been able to see the defendant sitting at a counsel table, there is nothing in the record that indicates how tall he was, how strong he was, or any of the other factors that this court pointed out in Eskridge that should be considered, except that he was an adult.
say he volunteered to go over. I mean, my children have babysitters and they love to have I guess you could say it's a volunteer babysitter. The state place that the record says that his mother said that the judge was in charge, the mother said he had to mind the defendant. The child was 10 years old, so he certainly wouldn't leave his child unattended. I have a hard time accepting that you don't have a babysitting relationship. I can still see your argument that a babysitter is not the same as a parent, but are you conceding that this is a babysitting relationship, or are you still trying to deny a babysitting relationship?
This is not a babysitting relationship, Your Honor, and you raise a critical point. In this case, the testimony revealed that the victim was told, when you go to Mr. Dye's house, you mind him, or I will bring you home. There was nothing in the record that the victim's mother said, you mind Mr. Dye or he can punish you. Or you mind Mr. Dye and he can do anything.
But isn't the punishment the fact that he wouldn't be able to go over there again?
That's punishment from the parent, not from the abuser. And this court has looked at the punishment implicit when a parent abuses a child. So here, that there's a distinction that the punishment would not come from Mr. Dye, but would instead come from the victim's mother, not allowing him to visit Mr. Dye any longer. Mr. Dye was not given any authority by the victim's mother to punish the victim.
What do we do with the testimony of David that Mr. Dye made him do it, essentially? What does that mean?
Your Honor, that's a very good question. There is no elaboration on that in the record as to what made means. Given that the jury was left to consider the meaning of that term, made does not necessarily mean force as the General Assembly intended it to be. Made can do it as part of the act of committing the sexual abuse. There must be something more than that when a parent-child relationship is not involved. If this court were to expand the Esper standard to apply to non-parent child sexual abuse, the standard would become unworkable.
Why does there have... There has to be more... Why? Because force or threat of force is not suggested by made me do it. Isn't that something for a jury to decide? This Eskridge test, I guess I don't understand why we can't just look at the statute without considering the parent-child relationship. And this isn't... Clearly it's not that. And so why don't we just look at the words of the statute and decide whether a jury could decide that a child's testimony, he made me do it, he pulled my pants down, he turned me over and so forth, that that's enough to suggest that a 9-year-old is being forced by an adult to do something that an adult should not require a 9-year-old to do.
Your Honor, that is not sufficient to prove force. And the courts that have found force have looked at things like a defendant who has forced the leg of the victim over, or a defendant who has pinned the victim against the floor, or a defendant who has moved a dresser in front of the door to block the victim's exit from the room. Those things are compulsion against the victim to make the victim act in a certain way. That's beyond the force required to commit the offense. Made in this case, is that simple reference is he made me commit this sexual act. That force, if there is any force, is the force that's required to commit the rape. And there's nothing in the record that suggests there's anything beyond that.
But you're not saying that it isn't a question of fact to be determined by the jury.
It is a question of fact to be determined by the jury. And as the Court of Appeals found, there was not sufficient evidence in the record that a reasonable jury could have found the force. And that was even under a lower standard as opposed to reading the plain statute as you suggested, Chief Justice Moore. Under an Esper standard where the court would have lowered what was required to prove force, the main standard found there still was not enough.
There is nowhere in the testimony of the child that he did not want this, any of this, to happen.
And he did not want this to happen?
Yes.
There is reference to that, yes, Your Honor. In fact, one of the things that the victim said was he allowed this to happen because he believed that if the defendant committed this act a long enough period of time, that the defendant would be convicted and sent to prison for a long time.
So you can't say that this child consented to this?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. We could never argue that a 9-year-old could consent to this type of abuse or that anyone could consent to this type of abuse. However, consent is not the question. The question is, did the state through force such that a life sentence could be imposed on this defendant.
But it's force. It's tough. It's a tough issue because you're saying force in addition to the obvious implicit force in the crime itself.
Absolutely.
But the statute doesn't really say, you know, we know that there's force implicit in the crime. The statute just says if it's committed with force. And the first reaction is, well, of course, there's always force. So we know that the General Assembly had to mean something to enhance the penalty.
Correct. Mr. Dye was charged with rape of a child under 13. There's no requirement for the state to prove force under the charge that in front of Mr. Dye.
Is it possible that the General Assembly just was trying to make a distinction between a consensual, a 13-year-old, you know, we know that goes on, a consensual with an adult and a 13-year-old consensual would still be the crime without force? Is it possible that that was the distinction and that we should only look to whether or not the encounter was consensual?
Certainly, that could be a distinction that the General Assembly was trying to...
And in that event, this wasn't. I mean, it would not be... There'd be sufficient evidence to send this to the jury if consensual were the test.
That's true. However, the General Assembly had the opportunity, since this court decided Estridge and Shine, to revisit this issue, knowing that the force was being considered as an enhancement. And the General Assembly could have clarified the meaning of the statute and has not. Instead, the General Assembly has allowed this court's interpretation of force to continue, which suggests that the General Assembly may have had more than one meaning. Unfortunately, there are no legislative notes, committee notes to the statute to tell us what the General Assembly intended as the force in the statute. However, the General Assembly has provided us with more than one provision in the rape statute. There's rape of the child under 13. There's also rape by force. In that situation, the prosecutor could charge under a rape by force section whether the victim is under 13 or not. What the General Assembly has provided is an opportunity for the state to charge someone who has raped a child under 13 in more than one way, by force, or simply because the child is under 13, but there was additional force beyond that, such that the victim or that the defendant should be sentenced to life in prison. Under the totality of the circumstances, the state failed to introduce sufficient evidence to prove force in this case. The record is devoid of any evidence from the victim himself that he felt forced, that he was forced to do this. He told the emergency room doctor and the social worker who interviewed him less than 36 hours after the last act of abuse that he was not forced. He testified that he considered Mr. Dye a friend and that he was not afraid of him. The record has no evidence about the size, weight, or strength of Mr. Dye. All factors this court has said should be considered. Based on that, this court should affirm the decision of the Ninth District Court of Appeals, finding that there was not force, and reversing his life sentence.
Thank you, Mr. Wall. Mr. Dr. Duck, please take 3 minutes.
Your Honor, I do not read Estridge basically to do away with the element of force. My understanding is Estridge, of course, looks at the facts of the case and indicated that the defendant removed the panties of the child. I think Estridge basically interprets the word compulsion in the force statute. And how do we prove compulsion? You can look at psychological factors. And I think the psychological factors that you look at to prove compulsion apply to whether the defendant is the biological parent of the child or is a caregiver of the child. So depending on the facts and circumstances of the case, the caregiver of the child can have more authority over the child than the natural parent. Because in some situations, you might have a natural heir to the child once a month if it's a non-custodial relationship, whereas the caregiver, in some circumstances, will have custody and control of that child from 7 a.m. till 7 at night. When you may have one parent working, they'll drop the child off the babysitter before they go to work. They come back at 7 o'clock at night, and they pick up the child. That child has a bond with the babysitter, who is a non-parent authority figure.
you cannot ignore that relationship in determining whether or not the state proved compulsion. I was at least glad to see that it seems that the defendant has abandoned the three-part test from the Ninth District Court of Appeals. He did not argue that's the proper test or where that test originated from. Basically, it looks like that test just came out of nowhere. That is not the proper test. The proper test should be the totality of the circumstances. And we look at this case, and I believe Chief Justice pointed out there are physical factors in this case. The physical factors are that, number one, the defendant pulled down the child's pajamas. He actually physically turned the child over to have anal sex with him. He physically turned the child over a second time so the child could have oral sex with him, and he could have oral sex with the child. The child's testimony is that he made me do these things. Those are physical factors which support the jury's decision in this case. Plus, you have the non-physical factors. The fact that the defendant was over this defendant's house once a week for a period of approximately 6 months. His mother told him to mind the defendant. The defendant was in charge. And I also have a five-year-old at home, and I tell my five-year-old when I leave him off the babysitter, this person is in charge. That is a very natural thing to do. We all have done it when we are parents. When we drop off the child at preschool, we drop off the child at babysitter, aunt, uncle, we tell the child this person is in charge. And the child must obey that person. When we determine whether or not there's compulsion, you cannot ignore that factor. That person is in charge. Basically, Your Honor, I'm asking this court to apply the expert standards to non-parental guardian figures, and that those non-parental guardian figures have as much control, if not more control, depending on the facts and circumstances of each individual case. I ask this court to reverse the Ninth District Court of Appeals and to affirm the jury's verdict. If there are any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bachner. The case is submitted. We'll be advised of our opinion.